Bing, 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 bing. It's live from NYU and Studio 20. We're actually in a studio. Is this, Jay, is this Studio 20 that we're in?
This is Studio NYU.
Does it have a name?
It doesn't have a name yet. We could give it a name.
We're going to have to do that.
Yeah, this is the fourth time we've done Rebooting the News from the studios at NYU.
Yes, we have to speak softly, I've been told.
And maybe, Dave, you want to describe our setup a little bit so listeners know where we are when we're doing this.
Well, interesting. Well, it's a studio. I mean, what else can you say? It's got big microphones, and we're wearing headphones, and I can actually see you, but you're behind glass. I'm sitting in the control room with a man named Adrian. I don't know your last name, Adrian.
Mahi.
Doesn't matter. Adrian says it doesn't matter. And Adrian is, we actually now have an engineer, if you can believe that. And we're learning. This is the fourth. I'll post a picture on the site. But we're learning how to do this. We are also going out live to Blog Talk Radio. So if anybody's listening live, they're getting it. We hope to be able to do dial-in guests, same as we always were, but without sacrificing the studio quality.
Right.
That's the cool thing, is we get the best of both. When we shoot out the MP3 to, you know, through the podcast feed, we're getting high quality, but we also get the live, real-time feed, too.
So we're bringing in some of the elements of professional broadcasting, but we're also leaving some of those elements out.
Which ones? I think this feels very professional to me.
It is, but we're not trying to present a fully sculpted thing.
No.
We're not editing out the ums and the ahs.
No.
We don't have some slick music. We are leaving a lot of the packaging out.
Totally. Well, we have the Blog Talk Radio intro at the beginning.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty slick, don't you? Okay, you don't have to answer that. This actually relates to something we'll talk about a bit later. Relative to the giant pool of money, about whether you want all that professionalism. Okay, so it's not so much that it's professional. It's definitely not professional.
It's, I mean, somewhat Adrian, produced, though.
Right. Adrian asked for some money, and I said I would give him some money. So that basically makes it professional. But since we were joking, it's only humorously professional.
Well, let's say it this way. It's actually amateur radio at a very high level of quality.
There you go. It's super high-quality amateur radio.
There you go.
Right.
In other news from these environs, I decided to re-debut PressThink this week. I had not been writing at PressThink since April of 2009 for a variety of reasons, although I had been still blogging at other sites like... Tumblr and Posterous and guest posts at Read Write Web and LA Observed and other places. But I had gotten out of the habit of posting my 2,000 to 3,000 word think pieces at PressThink, which was my style. And something that Danny Sullivan, who writes a really good blog about search, said on Twitter, sort of motivated me. He said that he missed it when people had websites they owned and pointed at. Why lease your soul to Facebook or Buzz or whatever? Master your own domain, he said, which is actually a theme that we had been discussing on Rebooting the News some months ago. And I understood what he was saying, and I realized that while I like posting at these other sites, I like the idea of writing across the web, I also I love having my own site that I control, that is my domain. And so when I started writing this piece, I realized about 500 words in that this is my next PressThink post. So what it's about, if I could take a minute to talk about
it. Well, before you move off that, I want to pause on that idea. I think that that's like being green. You know, it's the equivalent of being green. When you post on all these other sites that are corporate owned, you are trading a bit of the future of the web away. When you write on PressThink, you're helping the web by making it more distributed, by not making it centralized, by not having bottlenecks, by not allowing, I mean, right now they're not controlling what you say, although they're starting to in certain other contexts, maybe not what you and I say yet, but there is, the corporations are starting to behave badly, and there's always the potential that they could, even when they weren't behaving badly, there was always the potential that they could. So it's a good thing. He's right. Danny Sullivan's right. It's good for you to write and press things. It's not bad for you to point to those things from Twitter and from Facebook. And it's not bad to, I mean, whatever. You know, I'm not going to say you shouldn't have a Coke or a Pepsi every once in a while. But you should also drink some tap water, too, every once in a while, too, because that's good for the environment.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I like owning my own space. I like doing my own thing. I like... Mm-hmm. Owning my own URL shortener,
sure,
and owning my own words,
right?
So it's related to all of that. So anyway, what I wrote about the post is called what is it called? It's called "The Quest for Innocence and the Loss of Reality in Political Journalism," and it was occasioned by a single line in what was actually a very good report that appeared in the New York Times on the Tea Party movement. And the author, David Barstone, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and a very talented journalist, had spent 5 months, Dave, five months.
That's huge.
Researching a single 4,500-word article. Had to be at least over $100,000 in costs for this one piece. Traveling around the country, going to Tea Party rallies, talking to lots of people from different places. The Tea Party isn't like one thing. It's sort of a loose collection of a lot of different groups. So you have to spend a lot of time with those people to really understand where they're coming from. And that's what he did. And in the course of observing what binds these people together, he said that after a while you realize that underneath a lot of their words and their concerns is a narrative of impending tyranny. That's the way he put it, a narrative of impending tyranny. And I read that and I read a little further and I realized that he had no intention of telling us whether this narrative of impending tyranny was actually factual or true or based on anything or grounded in reality. And I thought that was interesting. And the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to write about it, because this choice to tell us about the narrative that is animating them, but not to try and ground it in any reality, is an odd decision. And so what I tried to do in my post was explain why professional journalists do things like that. Mm-hmm. And
why do they do things like that?
Well, the idea I introduce...
But wait, should they be doing things like that?
I don't think they should. And the idea I introduce at PressThink, which you can get by going to PressThink.org, is that there's an agenda interfering with truth-telling and factual description in pro-journalism. And the agenda is what I call the quest for innocence, meaning an attempt to advertise that the pro-journalist is not part of this group and is not part of that and is not implicated or involved and is standing apart from the scene. Mm. And
but they pick their battles. There are times when they don't appear aloof and out of it. A great example was there was a piece about the loser, the Ukrainian loser who died in a... He was...
Georgian.
Georgian.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, Georgian. Who died in a practice run. And there was a piece in the Times, and it was clearly labeled a report. And when I pointed to it, some people said, no, that was an editorial. But no, it said, you know, the following reporters contributed, people contributed to this report. They called it a report. And they used the term callous to describe the International Olympic Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just a side thing. It was the whole theme of the article. It was the fact that they were, you know, that they weren't sincere in their feeling of grief. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a, you know, I thought, what a striking comparison. Because so many times when it comes to issues relating to technology, and this was happening at exactly that time relative to Buzz, they would lay off the opinion on privacy experts. And I feel the same way you do. Why not tell us whether or not there is a privacy issue? Mm. It seems like that's, in the case of the Tea Party, I think I can understand that they didn't, dive into that, because that's an incredibly difficult question to answer as to whether or not, what was the phrase again?
I don't think so.
There's impending doom. I feel that there's impending doom all over the place. So if you're expecting the answer to be no, there's no, that the Tea Party
not
people.
Not doom, but the.
What was the actual
term?
Well,
this is my point. If the United States is this close to becoming a tyranny, meaning losing basic
it's a bigger story,
freedom,
right?
That is a story right. that I would expect to be finding in the New York Times regularly.
Absolutely. There are so many stories you should be seeing in the New York Times regularly that you don't see.
If there is any basis to this narrative, then you ought to be telling me about it. But what you're really telling me is we don't actually think there's any basis to this narrative.
You think they're saying that?
Well, if they weren't saying that, then they should be on
the
stick.
The absence of the story on the front page every day
Correct.
Sort of tells you that they've decided that there is no issue.
That's right.
And that the Tea Party people are out to lunch. And
which is like a wink to certain readers.
Absolutely. There's no question that they don't need to say this. I can't say there's no question because they don't say. But it seems
if you are trying to explain the Tea Party movement, it would seem to me to be important to know that the unifying theme of this movement is actually
unrealistic,
a paranoid fantasy.
Unrealistic
paranoid. That would be part of the description that you would try to offer if you were attempting to explain the phenomenon.
So why
not an opinion at all?
Why don't they put that in there?
Because it would violate this other agenda that I tried to bring into words, the quest for innocence.
There might be another reason. There might be another reason.
All right. Well,
you want to hear another theory?
Sure.
Okay. That they're afraid, they don't want to get into this whole argument with the right wing, that they're biased and they're trying to lean over backwards to be fair to them and give them a fair shot.
Okay, but that is an invalid interference.
No, of course. We'll agree on that one. Yeah.
Anyway, it's fun. I'm enjoying this because this post is doing well. It's on Boing Boing this morning. It's
here comes Jay.
It's getting a lot of traction.
That's good.
It's fun to blog. It's like a great way to be a writer because you're in dialogue with the web. So anyway, that was worth noting.
Where should we go from here?
I'm really interested in this Iceland thing, and I wanted to mention it. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but it's definitely related to the rebooted system of news, because there's a move afoot within the parliament in the country of Iceland to pass a package of laws that would kind of make Iceland an important outpost in the rebooted system of news by bringing into law there a series of protections that is kind of the best of the international scene for libel protections, for freedom of the press issues, for protecting against unreasonable search of servers, for creating a kind of oasis of openness that would benefit the world communication system as a whole. And I just think it's a striking example of how the rebooted system of news is an international phenomena. And if it is based in many places around the world rather than relying on one state or one system of laws, that's just a strength. Now, there's a long way to go before this vision of Iceland as kind of a haven for 21st century journalism comes to pass, and it may never actually be effective, but it's just an inspired move by a country.
Well, what would be the upshot of this? I mean, so would you, if you wanted to open, it was inspired by WikiLeaks, right? The guy who does WikiLeaks, he gets sued all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The What's the term? Something tourism?
Libel tourism.
Libel tourism, right?
Yeah.
And so people like to go sue people in Great Britain because their libel laws are so in favor of the person who was claiming to be libeled.
Mm-hmm.
So now if you base your news organization in Iceland, that means you're immune from that, or?
Well, it might make it harder for a court in England to enforce any judgment.
I guess the courts in
England can do what they want to do because it's a sovereign country.
Right.
But it might make it harder for them to actually take any action against you.
Presumably the WikiLeaks guys know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. They've been...
Iceland as a country is in desperate shape, too.
They are.
Indeed. That. They need something to... because they got hooked into this whole leverage... mortgage,
amazing,
whatever.
Amazing yeah. collapse of trust in the country. And this move to try and become kind of a haven for watchdog journalism is actually related to this collapse because they suffered from extreme opacity in their financial dealings.
Mm.
And it's a reaction.
So it's a good way to reform.
Yeah, it's part of reform.
Take your medicine, eat your vegetables, mm-hmm. Get your freedom of speech together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of freedom of speech, there's a great bit of news that the Polk Award went to someone who was anonymous.
Yes.
Yeah. And my mother told me about this, and she said, isn't it wonderful? Because my mother is discovering blogging in a whole new way now. She's a very active blogger, and she's learning all these things. You know, it's like it's refreshing because every time I hear somebody say, well, you know, nobody blogs unless there's a way to make money doing it. I go, well, yeah, no. Lots
true.
Of people blog because there's no... Some people blog to spend money, right?
Yeah.
And my mom is a perfect case, perfect example of this. And she gave me this story. She sent me a pointer to this story as an example of somebody who was so selfless in their blogging and their reporting that they're not even coming forward to accept their award. Well, I didn't know what it was about until I read the article. And of course, they're not coming forward because if they were to come forward, they probably would be tried and quickly shot.
Well, it's a little bit more interesting than that.
Is
that
it?
Polk Committee gave the award not to an individual,
hmm.
but to, in a sense, citizen journalism itself.
Is that right?
Because it was not a single individual that was responsible for getting this video out to the world.
Right.
There was somebody who recorded it. There was a doctor involved who told other people about it. There was somebody who uploaded it to YouTube. And actually, the number of people involved in getting this, quote unquote, out is unknown.
Right.
And so what they did was give the award sort of to this act itself, to the attitude that we should inform the world and we have the tools to do so, and when called upon, we should use those tools.
Total milestone then. Absolutely
yeah.
a moment. This came up at the Thursday meeting. This is a good way to segue into that. And most of the people in the room were, when I wrote this story, if you assemble a group of random people in Silicon Valley, or in the tech industry, or California, what they'll end up talking about is user-generated content. That's going to be the focus. And when you do it in New York, you get a different focus, I think. I mean, I'm a newbie here. In a way, I'm like fresh off the boat. Even though I was born and raised here, this is a whole new experience for me. And the focus here when a conversation starts is how do people get compensated for originating news stories. So the model is you've got a reporter, you've got a copy editor, you've got a whole set of editors involved. And the example that was brought up was the giant pool of money. And mm-hmm. I learned something about that I didn't know. And we've talked about that before. This is
yes, and I've written about it.
Right. What do you call that? The
National Explainer Model.
Explainer Model.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And so this was, and all these people in the room were familiar, or most of them were familiar with this term, so they were using it. And something I didn't know was the giant pool of money took months to create.
Yes.
And a lot of money.
Yes.
And so this was offered as evidence that whatever we do in the rebooted news system, it's going to be just like the old system because it's going to require this kind of investment to actually create these explainers, right? And so I tried bravely to object to that. And
wait a minute, that's really what people were saying? It's going to be just like the old system? Well, or that it should include this part?
I think we're going to have to let them speak for themselves. All but right. This is what I heard, okay? And I let it run. You know, as you know, the BloggerCon model of conference, which is what we're using here, is heavily moderated. And so when a discussion sort of drones and repeats and only covers one side, the moderator, the discussion leader, is supposed to stop it, right, and redirect it and try to get the flow to be more interesting, right? Because I don't know if any – I mean, I have to ask the other people in the room if they found this interesting. I sure didn't, because it was only coming from one side. But I decided let's let it run because I'm still learning. The whole thing – I know how to run these things when – everybody in the room is familiar with the model. That's easy, right? If everybody in the room is familiar with the model and has bought into it and understands the value of that mode of conference, then it's relatively easy to do it. It's not easy when there are people in the room who do not know what the model is and/or have not bought into it. And so we were getting a bunch of sort of resistance, and I decided instead of because I didn't want to focus on the resistance, just let it run, see what happens. And it only went in that one direction. Now, I tried to bring up a counterexample, and I did bring up a counterexample. And it was from Fresh Air. And it was an episode they had now. I didn't write down the particulars. I have it on the blog. We'll have it in the show notes. But it was about all the options for the American healthcare system when it gets reformed. And it was a phenomenal show. It was 40 minutes. It was two segments of Fresh Air. Not the full, I don't think it was the full hour. And the author had written this wonderful book, which had obviously done a huge amount of work. So I'm not, what I'm making is a subtle point, right? Because I'm not saying you don't need to do the work, right? It was great because he went through all the different healthcare systems and he went to Canada, Germany, France, Japan, and compared it with the United States. And the point was basically we're getting the worst of everything. We're paying the most. We're getting nothing. And right. There's a tremendous amount of waste. The Swiss, he went into the Swiss system too. And I came out of this with it's 1,000 times more knowledge. I was actually prepared to discuss intelligently after having listened to this, whereas before, all I knew was that the healthcare system in the United States wasn't
broken,
for me, it wasn't broken. For me, it was working. Mm. So the way I would put it is it wasn't getting to everyone, right? There were a lot of people that weren't covered. Because I'm financially relatively well off and I know the importance of this stuff and I've had some major illnesses myself, for all these reasons, I have good health care. Good coverage, but there are a lot of people who
don't.
But
isn't this the professional model?
Well, yeah. You see, that's where people... No, it's not. It is not the professional model, and here's why. You put words in my mouth. Sure, the guy's a professional, and he got an advance from a book publisher. My point is, though, it's like if you follow the line that says you need to do these heavy productions for each of these things and spend a lot of money producing this information, producing the news, then it will never lead you to this one. This will never be on your... Because this is a pool of knowledge that's sitting there, and it's not being used, okay? It's not costing NPR any money whatsoever to put this guy in front of a microphone for 40 minutes. It's costing a little bit of money because they have to pay Terry Gross's salary, the engineer's salary, probably some distribution costs. It's nothing compared to what we're talking about with the giant pool of money. There's no reason to wait. In other words, had this been a breaking story, right, like there would be no reason to wait months to get this guy on Fresh Air to talk about it. Mm. And in fact, Fresh Air was doing it. They had Gretchen Morgenson, I think was her name, from the New York Times, a financial reporter. So my point was you don't have to spend a huge amount of money doing this. You can be more creative. You can find the knowledge in a lot of places. I don't want to get amateur is the wrong word. I don't want to get superficial, ignorant sources of information. I want to get depth. I want to get experience. I want people who have been studying this stuff for years. I just don't think that they have to be acting in the mode of professional journalists. Look at the compensation that this guy, it's a perfect situation. They didn't pay him anything, right? He didn't get paid a penny to do this, I assume.
He didn't get paid to do Fresh Air.
Right.
He got paid to do the research.
Correct. And he got his compensation, presumably in the form of promotion for his book.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect win-win.
Well, so what I don't understand, Dave, is why do we have this polarized conversation where either it's we need to preserve professional journalists and pay people to do this, or we don't need professional journalists, we can just use existing experts. I don't understand the intelligence of that. It seems like
it's
a
not
stupid
an
split.
Well, you know, we both agree on this one.
Okay,
that we don't need to have a split. We need to get the information wherever it's going to come to us for however
we're
going to get
it. Yeah, that's the rebooted system of news.
Right, we'll take it for however we get it. But that's why I said in the headline for my piece is, does it matter where you get the news from?
Right.
It doesn't matter. As long as you're getting, you know, good information, and it's presented to you in a way that you understand it. We all agree that you can't make intelligent decisions about things like healthcare, here the economy was crumbling. Maybe you didn't have any decisions to make, but you sure wanted to know what is going on. Why, you know, nobody understood it. And after listening to it, you did understand
what
it.
What we need is a single set of standards to prevail across the entire system, whether it's professionals spending months on a story, or authors telling us what they know, or amateurs reporting on their experience, or accidental journalists who happen to be there recording what they saw.
Or college professors spend a whole lifetime studying something, don't have any particular upside in explaining it other than they're glad to share
their knowledge.
They share what they know, right? This is also a big impulse, a human impulse. Not everything has to have a business model.
I think that's correct.
Right.
And that allows us to transition into something else I wanted to note this week, a little item that appeared at Romanesco, which is a media news site that I follow closely and other journalists follow closely. And it was simply remarks made by Bill Kovach, who you wouldn't necessarily know him, Dave, but people in journalism would, because he's a former Washington bureau chief of The New York Times. He's the former editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, also ran the Nieman Foundation at Harvard for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of a gray beard, a patrician figure within the press and a journalistic heavyweight, somebody I respect a great deal, has a good professional background. And he's speaking at an awards dinner, something that happens hundreds of times a year in journalism. And he happens to tell the group that the new journalism must be one that is open to both amateur and professional reporters. And this is not a startlingly new idea. It's something that I've been saying for a long time, but the fact that it's now coming from him in this awards dinner in a sort of very ordinary mainstream setting is just a small sign of how changed the world is, because it's not a fight anymore. And the notion of a news system that spreads across the world and combines pros and amateurs with, as I said just now, a single set of standards is now so clearly necessary and viable that even establishment figures are telling their listeners, this is the way it is.
Just in time for a whole new fight. Which is totally brewing. I have another piece coming very soon. It's just like it's dawning on me now that the tech industry is at war with us now. I mean, it really is. They're starting to come out and not hide it anymore.
The war is over what?
I don't know, Jay. And the funny
war against the users?
I don't think they would ever express it as the war against the users.
So what are they at war at?
Well, what they want is control of the flow. They want, each one of them is competing to control what you, they want to control the media. They want to control what you and I care about. Because there's huge money in controlling that. Because that's where their margins are going to come from in the future. So you find an example, I just wrote a piece before coming over here, that was called When to Be Worried. Mm-hmm. And And the answer is really simple. You want to be worried when one company has a very sizable piece of the culture on their servers, and that company is Apple. The music industry stores almost all their content on Apple servers. If it's not on Apple servers, it's on Amazon servers. And you want to be worried. That's a good time to start being worried, is when that happens, okay? But you want to really bump up the worry when they start expressing an interest in the content, in what's actually on there, and actually taking things off their servers because of the content.
Mm-hmm.
So they're starting to remove apps from their store for iPhone users and iPod.
I've read a little bit about this.
And this is, they're picking on an industry that's very easy to pick on. They're saying they don't want sexually suggestive images.
Right.
And they haven't said, they actually haven't said that they don't want sexually suggestive images. They haven't said anything, and they haven't answered any questions about this either. They've just been kicking the products out.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people watch this, they're seeing the dots get connected, and that's the conclusion people are drawing. The reporters have tried to get through to Apple. Apple isn't taking any questions about this. Then you really, maybe it's too late to be worried when, in addition to hosting a large part of the culture on their servers and expressing an interest in that content, in the culture, that they're also shutting off alternate avenues for content to flow. And it's very naive to think that they want to get rid of Flash because Adobe is lazy, or because it's buggy, or it uses too much memory, or all the crazy, awful reasons that they've cited. They've been very dirty about how they've done this. It's the big lie. They're saying that because Adobe isn't open, and because there are better open technologies that they can use. Well, it's funny, because what these open technologies will allow them to do is to completely close off the alternate avenues. So the store will be the only way content flows. Now, why do they want to do that? Probably because they get to charge for everything that comes through the store. That's giving them the benefit of the doubt, okay? And saying there isn't any strange deal that they're doing with anybody else. It's possible they can make money by trading favors amongst themselves. They may have channels of communication. For all we know, the competition that is presented between Google and Apple isn't competition at all. It's possible.
Sort of, this is your domain, and we'll have our domain, and we'll stay out of yours, and you'll stay out of ours, that kind of a thing.
And maybe their deal is with the government, too. I mean, who has an interest in controlling what's said on the networks? I can't really see the business interest for Apple, but the government has an interest in that, and so it's a nasty situation. What we depend upon. So when you say that the epiphanies are starting to happen, and I see it elsewhere too. I have had some meetings with book publishers just because I'm thinking about writing a book, right? And when we talk about this stuff, I ask them about where they're at, and I'm very encouraged. They're, unlike the newspapers, which I've been very discouraged by their attitude towards the tech industry, they seem to be laying down on for the tech industry, and they seem to have this idea that, well, if we pretend we're not in competition with them, then they won't be in competition with us, which is nonsense. The tech industry may not see themselves as in competition with the news industry, but they don't necessarily look out for the interests of the news industry. And they may well do things that are counter to the industry's interests. And, I've always maintained that the news industry needs to have a very solid foundation of technology that they own and control, so that news can be represented in technology, not be controlled by technology. So I don't know.
The book industry, you're saying, has an insight into this?
Well, yeah. The book industry is fighting Amazon. They're fighting Apple.
Yeah.
They're, because they see the writing on the wall there. And, Amazon, I learned, is selling books at below the cost. In other words,
right.
The book publishers sell them to them for $12 a book, and they in turn sell them for $10. And this freaks the publishers out.
Meanwhile, explain this to me. Marcos of Daily Kos posts the other day on Twitter. I finally sent in the final copy of my new book, American Taliban. Now comes the long wait for production. It'll be out in September. What the hell is that?
What do you mean?
Why does it take the book industry from
that's
February?
Not very long, Jay.
From February to September?
I don't know.
It seems like a long time to me.
Well, the movie industry does it too. I went to see Shutter Island. Sorry, not Stutter Island. Shutter Island, a new Martin Scorsese movie. I love his movies, and so this one came out. Well, it turns out this one was ready to ship last fall, and they held
on. So the book industry is no worse than Hollywood.
It's not worse. What they do is they wait until they have the distribution system is what. Who knows? It's crazy.
It's crazy. Exactly.
And we don't. I mean, you know, someday I will actually probably write a book, and I'll have to deal with this too.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
but
it would seem to me that if they were getting with the web and with the transformation of highly capitalized media industries, they would be a lot faster.
I'm sure we'll hear from some people in the book industry, and maybe they can explain to us what the rationale for this is. But they, could, of course, control that. But at least they're looking for avenues from the technology.
Ways around.
Yes, but the chances that they actually will find them are slim. Because you have to have really woken up to this one seriously years and years and years ago. When I wrote the piece about when it's time to be worried, the point was we're way past the point when it's time to be worried.
Mm-hmm.
It's too late to be worried now. And, you know, I've been ringing these alarms all along, and it's just not – like when I said – I said we'd come back to this because when – okay, now you see why it's really good that you write for your own blog.
Sure.
What it's saying basically is that if they decide to screw with you on Twitter or on Facebook, well, of course they're going to. They already have, right? The suggested user list was a perfect example of this, right?
Or the tumbleweeds at FriendFeed.
What are the tumbleweeds at FriendFeed?
Well, FriendFeed was bought by
Facebook. Oh, right. Oh, I see what you're right.
And now it's like a ghost town.
Exactly. The tumbleweeds. Because comes up in another context, so I was really puzzled. Yes, right. And so now at least your readers will know again that they can find you.
Yeah, and in an emergency, they can find me at pressthink.org.
Correct. That's why I keep writing at scripting.com. Because,
yeah.
And the flow is. I'm doing great. I mean, a lot of people read me on scripting.com. It's up every year. And at the same time, I'm very active on Twitter. And at some point, I'd like to have my own system that works, that has all the benefits of Twitter, all the benefits of Facebook, but absolutely none of the dependence on these corporations.
Well,
and wait, I just want to say, we will have that.
We will.
There will be a point at which we'll be talking about that. And I will say, Jay, do you remember how I've been talking about this for years and years and years? Here it is. Finally, mm-hmm. We're there. Because what's happening now is 10 times worse than what was happening in the build-up to the web. The web was, we couldn't see the web on the horizon in 1992 and 1993. It was there, but you couldn't see it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What you could see, though, is the utter mess that the technology industry was making of their own space. The difference here, though, is two. One is it's much bigger now, okay? And so the effects are much larger. We're now, you couldn't have said the culture of our society was on one company's servers in 1992. It wasn't true, okay? It is now true. In some dimensions, that is true,
mm-hmm.
Right? So that's an important difference. It's much, much bigger now. And I don't remember what the other difference was.
Well, one of the things I try to pay very close attention to is the constant battle between open and closed, open systems and closed systems.
Yeah, but don't be fooled about what open and closed mean, because they'll throw all those words around. Somebody posted a comment, said open is the new evil. You can make open mean anything you want it to be. The only open that matters is whether or not you're free to put whatever you want to on the web.
Well,
to you and me, that's what matters.
I'm not swallowing someone's slogans, Dave. I'm not a victim of propaganda about it. I'm using my mind. When I say I'm tracking open versus closed, what I mean is we have to continually ask ourselves, what is truly open and who's truly on the side of open? And I think what's tricky about it is that technologies of openness can easily flip over and become instruments of the closed and controlling, bottlenecking part of society. And we tend to invest the tools with kind of magic, and that's always a mistake, right? Because they can be turned for the opposite use. I mean, the same network that allows for open source wonderfulness allows for Al-Qaeda to organize, you know, in cyberspace.
Right.
So I think the question of where the open advocates are, where the people on the side of openness are, is always a difficult one. You can't assume that you know, but I think one of the reasons that we're here now is that the university is an institution that can be on the side of openness and should be. That's it's in its interest to do so. It shouldn't be allied with the forces of a closed media system. And I think that's one good reason to base.
It can be is a very good way of putting it, because it often has to compromise.
Sure.
Because it's got to pay the bills. And the money comes from somewhere. And
that's right. And often it comes from the industries that the university has to kind of press against.
Right. Exactly. Google was a good example of that, that they were very generous and they had this amazingly great PR, you know, that no, it was a hard, even to this day, there was an article yesterday in the San Francisco Chronicle that said, with all of the crazy stuff that Google is doing, that it's just their lack of experience that's at play here.
Mm-hmm.
What nonsense.
You
it's like, you know, you're buying a bill of goods there, guy. I mean, that's their story. Their story is, well, we're the don't be evil company. We are trying to be the good guys or whatever.
Well, I don't think anyone really buys that much anymore.
Yeah, they do. They do, because I think the press of all people, they're not, I mean, you come all the way back full circle to the thing we started talking about at the beginning. We need them to be much more circumspect about what's going on in the media. And the media increasingly, I mean, it may be only technology now that is the media. And that means covering them the same way you cover the car industry or the oil industry or, you know, politics in Washington, with the same cynical eye that you have for all those things. You know, it's wonderful. We love the gadgets and everything, but don't confuse the gadgets with the motives of the people that make them. They're different.
Well, I hope we can get better coverage than what we get of politics and industry. You wanted to make a few comments at the end here about Joel Spolsky and Marco and blogging. So go for it. We have 3 minutes.
Well, I also wanted to suggest about the audience, about possibility of actually, you know, directions we want to go with the podcast. Talk a little bit about Joel. There was a piece I read on Marco Arment's blog, marco.org. And apparently Joel Spolsky, who is an incredibly well-known and highly regarded technology blogger, programmer blogger, is going to stop blogging. And but he also has a fantastically successful podcast, and he's got a... So it's not like he's going away or anything. But the theory there was that that the programmers community, online community, is so harsh and so rude to its leadership, and that they're sort of the front line. Well, I liked reading the piece because I always thought it was just me. I always thought I was the only one. I was being singled out for this, but apparently it's not. Apparently, it's just. We also have to get better. We have to get better at discourse, I guess, is the other thing. Now, speaking of discourse, the idea that there was a thought that we could, like, have, well, we have the live component of Rebooting the News. You can listen to it live on Blog Talk Radio. And I was thinking also it might be an interesting idea, since we're in New York, and New York's a big place, and we're doing it in a public, semi-public facility here, that we could have, if people were interested in coming to the recording of Rebooting the News, that we might all, you know, have a talk afterwards, maybe go to lunch and talk about what was, have an open discussion about this. I'll just throw that out there. If you're in New York and you're interested, in making this a little bit more face-to-face interactive. I know I eat lunch every day. And
10 seconds.
So I love those kinds of discussions. So,
very cool.
Anyway, I think we're out of here, guys.
It's been a pleasure, Dave.
Right on. Thanks, Jay.
See you next week.